We're delighted to be with Ambassador Martin Indyk, who is the former United States Ambassador to Israel.
May I put in a plug before you?
Please do. I hope the plug is for Innocent Abroad.
It is. And one of the challenges with a book like this is typically it is an exercise in making oneself look good.
Mm. Or covering the tracks of the people.
Or covering various parts of the anatomy that are exposed, have been exposed, or justifying or rationalizing it. And if you did that, I can't find it. You were, I think, remarkably candid about, without being nasty about it, but very candid about the kinds of mistakes that you made, that the Americans made, that the Palestinians made, that the Egyptians, everybody has a piece of this. Everybody has a piece of it. And your willingness to, from a distance, to go back through, work through your records, think about it, and as you say, you'd intended to write this book from the beginning. So this is a very conscious process. But as an honest perspective from one person's very rich experience, it's a remarkable tool for understanding the Middle East to some extent, but also human failings, human challenges, and the opportunities to overcome those. Yeah. So that's a long way around saying thank you.
Thank you.
Well, thank you. I tried to write the book in that way, but the reason that I did that was because I felt a very personal responsibility for what went wrong.
Oh.
We started at the beginning of the Clinton administration. There I was as Bill Clinton, the president's Middle East advisor. And we set out to make comprehensive peace, to end the Arab-Israeli conflict. And for a while there, it really looked as if we were going to do it. For the first 2 years, everything was kind of fitting into place, not the place that we expected it to. We were trying to make peace with Syria and like Sadat and Carter. Rabin went off and made peace with the Palestinians, but okay, we adjusted and got behind it. Then we had an Israel-Jordan peace treaty, and then Rabin was assassinated. The whole process cratered, and then finally Barak was elected, and we tried again. We had a second chance, and the whole process cratered again, and ended up, instead of comprehensive peace, we ended up with what looked like comprehensive war. The Israelis and Palestinians at the end of the Clinton administration, were killing each other instead of talking about living together. And it was a real tragedy, from my point of view.
Well, and at one point,
and I felt, that since I was involved in, I had some responsibility to try to be as honest as possible, because I knew there would be a time would come again when a new president would set forth and try to make peace again. I had no idea it was going to be Barack Obama on day two, announcing that that's what he intended to do. But I felt at least obliged to try to discern the lessons from our experience, so that as a kind of lantern on the stern, so that he and his advisors, including Hillary Clinton, of course, would have some kind of guide to... They'll make their own mistakes, but at least they can avoid the mistakes that were made by Clinton and Bush.
Is there no institutional memory at all in our foreign policy?
Well, it's an interesting question, because basically when George W. Bush came in to office, he did not want to have anything to do with the peace process. His general attitude was, we used to joke, ABC, anything but Clinton. But in particular, he had this view that what Clinton and his peace team had done in the Middle East was stupid and feckless, and he wasn't going to do that. I recount in this book this meeting that I had with him, the only time I met with him. I was his ambassador for the first 6 months. I stayed on in Israel at his request, and I came back with Ariel Sharon, the newly elected prime minister, for his first meeting with the president. And after Sharon left the Oval Office, he asked me to stay behind, and he said to me, "What went wrong?" And I said, "Well, there's a lot of blame to go around, Mr. President, but essentially it was a lack of leadership." And before I had the chance to elaborate, he stopped me. He's famous for not being a very curious man, and he said, "That's right. No leadership. Barack and Clinton were two desperate men chasing after Yasser Arafat. They made him a generous offer. Arafat rejected it and resorted to violence. And now Sharon is prime minister. He's not going to offer what Barak offered and Arafat already rejected. So there's no Nobel Peace Prize to be made here, to be reached here. And he, you know, and that was it. And he said goodbye. So he summed it up.
For the next 7 years.
He was right, but his prescription was wrong. His analysis was right, but his prescription was wrong. Well, which is to say, to walk away from it.
Well, it's a comic book.
In terms of the institutional memory, what he did was he dismissed anybody who had anything to do with the peace process. You weren't even allowed, in his State Department, you weren't even allowed to use the words peace process. And Colin Powell came out to Israel before this visit. He said to me, I think we're just going to park this problem for a while. And I said to him, you can't park. It's on a steep hill and it doesn't have any brakes. But, you know, that was the attitude.
And you also quote one of the Bush people saying, we don't do diplomacy, we do policy, which to me was the most shocking thing I read in the whole book.
Yeah, but it's true. I mean, they eventually they came back to it. Condoleezza Rice, the Secretary of State, started to reintroduce the idea of diplomatic engagement. And in his last year, the president actually launched this Annapolis peace process. But by then, so much had been destroyed. And when they came to doing diplomacy, they didn't know how to do diplomacy. They had had such disdain for it. So Condoleezza Rice made, I don't know, 13 trips to the region, but she never tried to set up an objective, have her people prepare the ground, go in there with proposals, get the reactions, try to close the gaps. You know, none of the stuff of diplomacy was done. She just kind of turned up. And that won't do it.
If you don't believe in government and the efficacy of government, presumably that includes diplomatic undertakings. Right. And I go back to the clock. If you live in a clockwork universe, brute force works. If it's not a clockwork universe, then there is room for diplomacy, understanding, psychology, a whole range of different tools that I would assume is part of the tool set of a diplomat.
Exactly. Exactly right. I think, the brute force can shake things up in the Middle East, and there's plenty of history of that. But when that happens, the diplomats have got to come in and seize that moment, because people are more flexible in those moments to try to change the situation for better. The classic example of this in terms of Bush and Rice was the 2006 war in Lebanon, which had been provoked by Hezbollah. Israel responded, didn't really want to go back into Lebanon, but was kind of sucked into this, use of force, and of course it's got a lot more capabilities. Hezbollah was firing the rockets back. And basically, Bush and Rice kind of sat back and let them have at it, which was their default position. A failure to understand that when you've got a crisis like that, a hot conflict, you need to come in and try to get a ceasefire and re-establish new rules of the game. And eventually she did it, but by that time, it was too late. Same thing in Gaza. Of course, it was the last days of the administration, but we needed to be in there immediately. Look, that last crisis broke out because Hamas wanted to change the rules of the game of the ceasefire, and the Israelis wanted to change it too. And instead of the diplomats getting in there and saying, okay, this is not stable, let's work out a negotiated agreement that will, make it a more stable arrangement. Instead, it erupts with this terrible devastation. And again, we needed to be back in there, stopping the fighting and negotiating the ceasefire. But we didn't do that.
It also seems that the opportunity, this is true in lots of different places, and I assume it's true in diplomacy, when things start getting weird, when there's a dynamic, when people start moving off dead center, whether it's a war or somebody's health or a succession issue or whatever, once things become start moving, then they're in play again. And at that point, you're in a much better position if you're paying attention, if you know that's going on,
right.
If you have the intelligence.
Right.
I mean, both kinds of intelligence, then you're in a position to have an effect on where that settles back down again. Right, right. If you sit back and wait for it to happen by the time and wait for it to end, then people are back in their fixed positions.
Exactly.
And nothing's going to change.
Exactly. And then, you know, there's I think the Chinese word for crisis is danger and opportunity. And that's exactly right. And interesting, you know, Henry Kissinger is criticized for many things, especially Vietnam and so on. But in the Middle East, he understood exactly what you said. He understood when that war broke out, which if he'd had his antenna up, he would have known that Sadat was could not abide the status quo. But he didn't. He was off making detente with the Russians, with the Soviet Union. But he saw there was an opportunity, and he did seize it. He got the ceasefire, and he then built a peace process out of it.
The former American ambassador, the U.S. ambassador to Israel, Martin Indyk, is with us, and we trust you will be with the three of us when we return in just a moment.